Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara,
and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Somebody sent me, if you look on the read board, there's a picture of a girl in a bathing suit. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, and she deals with her own trauma. So anyway, the picture's there. She sent me a video of monkeys in Thailand getting out of the cage. I'll post it. Okay? I'll post it today. The monkey video. So it can kind of add context to Jeremiah's friend's admonition to himself. To him. Keep those monkeys in the cage, boy. You know what? That's like legit mental health advice. The oral tradition. You know, when you match that up with what I got told, hey, you're never getting over this. What? Now, I will tell you that it's not always delivered with, like, the appropriate bedside manner, because I don't know the Marines are good at that. But let me tell you, there's incredible wisdom in the advice. You're never getting over this. The single best piece of advice I ever got in my life. Well, I don't know. My mom, there's constantly, Michael, there's a time and a place for everything. I used to hear that shit. So anyway, that's pretty good advice. But I think the other advice, you're never getting over this, might be the best advice I ever got in my life. The advice that's helped me the most in my life. Maybe I should frame it like that. With that said, Charles Krauthammer sat down, right, and he did these things with a guy named Charles Kessler, right? It's called The American Mind. How about that? And here's what they discuss. Natural rights, John Stuart Mill, right, political philosophers, you know, right, and Krauthammer's intellectual journey. Okay, so one of the things I love about doing this program is, like, this thing pivots on a dime and goes from dumbass to, like, smart guy shit or smart girl shit in a heartbeat. Yeah, here you have it. So bear with me. Successes and failures in Iraq, all right? Krauthammer was a proponent of the invasion of Iraq, and you're going to hear him talk about that now.
Initial success. The toppling of a horrible dictatorship and the opening up of a possibility of a new strategic alignment in the Middle East, followed by a catastrophic four-year occupation where we did everything wrong, followed by an unbelievable success of the surge, which really snatched a victory from the jaws of defeat, followed by throwing it all away.
Yeah, this whole series is called The American Mind, if you want to listen to it on your own. It's awesome, though. Especially the violin music.
Let's fast forward a little bit to the Iraq invasion. Obviously, part of the reaction of the left to what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan has to do with the hostility or alienation from American exceptionalism that you were just talking about.
Right.
Looking back on it now, how do you evaluate Iraq as a success, as a failure?
Iraq was a initial success, the toppling of a horrible dictatorship, and the opening up of a possibility of a new strategic alignment in the Middle East, followed by a catastrophic four-year occupation where we did everything wrong, followed by an unbelievable success of the surge, which really snatched a victory from the jaws of defeat, followed by throwing it all away. As David Petraeus said in a remarkably candid interview just this week, meaning the week of mid-March in 2015, in which he said, after the surge, which ended around 2008, we were able to maintain the gains for 3 years until the end of 2011. Well, what happened at the end of 2011? We totally liquidated our presence, creating a vacuum into which Iran has come, into which Shiite extremism, Shiite militias came. The day after we withdrew, January 2nd, 2012, President Maliki, Prime Minister Maliki, the Shiite Prime Minister of Iraq, not only fired, but ordered the arrest of his Sunni Prime Minister. The Americans are gone. Now we do our score settling. 10,000 troops. Petraeus was asked whether that had made a difference. Stopped ISIS from invading. Remember, ISIS' ancestor was al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was not only defeated in the surge. It was humiliated in the surge when the Sunni Arabs of Anbar, who were the aggrieved party, who had a reason to be anti-American because the Sunnis had ruled Iraq for 100 years and we had overthrown that, and who initially joined with al-Qaeda in Iraq, they turned against al-Qaeda in Iraq. They joined us, the infidel. That was the ultimate humiliation, to be thrown out of Iraq and to be decimated by an alliance of the infidel with the local Sunnis. That's what the surge produced. And what people don't remember today is that in the spring of 2008, after we and the Iraqi Sunnis took care of al-Qaeda in Iraq, on the Sunni side, Maliki, who was not the best guy in the world, went to war against the Badr Brigades, the Shiite, Iranian-influenced militias, defeated them in Basra, fought them all the way up through Karbala and Najaf into Sadr City itself, and utterly destroyed them. So he took care of the Shiite extremists. We and the Anbar Awakening took care of the Sunnis. And there was great promise. And that was thrown away. A vacuum was created. There were no Americans around to moderate, to mediate as we had. So it was a success, a failure, a success, and an unconscionable throwing away of success.
And how long would Americans have had to be around to assure its success?
Well, 10,000 Americans. We've had four times that many in Korea for about 65 years, if I have that correct. We had a lot in Germany, a lot, of course, still in Japan. It wasn't as if it was an ongoing war. Obama himself said, as he announced the withdrawal, that we have a fairly stable and secure Iraq. It was holding together. It had promise. Now, like Petraeus, I'm not going to say we would have, you know, succeeded in producing a Jeffersonian democracy. But we had made tremendous advances, and there was a possibility. And I think it's a great tragedy that we didn't. Petraeus said, I can't tell you if that would have done it, but I would like to have had the chance to try.
Nonetheless, the experience leaves a bad taste in
experience
the American
experience has mouth. Produced the Vietnam syndrome all over again.
And so what do we do in Syria now? The choices are not particularly good.
Well, the choices today are nil. There were choices early on, and Obama rejected the advice of his own CIA director, his own Secretary of Defense, his own Secretary of State, the Intelligence Committee, everybody.
Who was then Hillary.
Well, Hillary Clinton herself, in not supporting the rebels, the revolution, when it was still overwhelmingly secular and when it had tremendous chances of success. I remember at one point early on, first year, there were rumors that Assad had already sent the family out of Syria. Remember the blowing up of the meeting of their security apparatus in Damascus. The rebels controlled a large part. Now that secular rebels have been so marginalized, they're essentially gone. We have to create something from nothing. So I think Syria is irredeemable. The only thing that could happen in Syria that would succeed, the Turks are very much afraid of and opposed to the Assad regime, and they're essentially in a proxy war with Iran, which controls the Assad regime. They see themselves as the new Ottomans. They ought to be the hegemon over Sunni Arab world instead of the Iranians. That's an offense. But they won't join us unless we say to them that we are equally opposed to Assad. We have said to the Turks, we want you to help us in Kobani to fight ISIS. And they say, we'll help you, but you can't give Assad a pass because that's our real fear and opponent. And we won't do that. So they're out of it. It's the Turks who could succeed in bringing down the Assad regime, but we're not going to do what they need us to do it over there.
So if we did what Charles Krauthammer recommends, we would be in a position of an offshore balancer, essentially, let the regional powers settle this themselves with our intervention or our finger on the scale only if necessary.
That's been American policy everywhere for 75 years, and it has had remarkable success. Who is the offshore balancer in the Pacific Rim? China, and then you've got all these Pacific Rim countries that are pro-American, they're relatively democratic, they're being threatened. We have the U.S. Navy. That's what creates the balance, and that's what keeps the peace. In the 1960s and 70s and the 80s, we were the balancer of last resort in the Middle East. At some point, sometimes you have to step in. In 91, Saddam takes over Kuwait. He threatens to become the hegemon of the entire oil patch, Middle East, on which the Western economy depends. And the regional powers are not strong enough to do anything. And George H.W. Bush says, this will not stand. And he says, I'm going in alone or with allies. And he accumulated a huge alliance because they knew that we were serious. So that's been our role everywhere as the offshore balancer. In a sense, that's the NATO story. The Russians were overwhelmingly conventionally superior at the end of the Second World War. They could have gone all the way to the Atlantic Ocean with their tanks. The reason they didn't is because of us. We were the offshore.
But wouldn't offshore balancing argue against the occupation of Iraq after victory in war?
I'm not sure that's true. Sometimes you have to go in, as we did with the first Gulf War. Sometimes you go in, and it doesn't work out, in part because the initial operation is successful. The threat is eliminated. The Saddam and his dynasty is wiped out. The problem in Iraq is there was no clear policy that we had, either to install maybe a Sunni general that we could trust, or to find some way in which we could ensure moderate Shiites. There was a party in Iraq which was sort of a mixed party led by a guy called Alawi, who was himself a Shiite but had a lot of Sunnis, who won the election of 2010. The mission of the Obama administration was to broker a coalition behind them. They gave the job to the vice president, and it will not surprise you to learn that it was an abject failure. And instead of getting this non-sectarian party to become the dominant party and to take over the government, we ended up with the Maliki, which had not won the election, the Maliki party, Iranian-influenced and very sectarian. And that was the beginning of the end of this idea of a benign successor government.
He's a smart dude. From Onion Man, Jesus Mac, my Cal State University education is well under par listening to these men. No, you know what? You have to do a little footnoting. You got to look up utilitarianism when these guys talk about it. But it's the underpinning of our philosophical, the philosophical basis for the founding of the nation. You can do it. It's just looking shit up. You got your phone there. You're sitting there doing nothing at work. So look it up. Krauthammer is smart. I don't, I'm interested to hear if he didn't care what the rational basis for the invasion of Iraq is. I can't imagine that to be true. You know, that he didn't care what the rational basis of the invasion of Iraq was. Cause in my opinion, I mean, to me, that's important to him. So I'm interested in that. Okay. But I want to play for you part three of the Jeremiah Workman interview. But I love listening to that stuff because he's a smart guy and he has this incredible journey from being a liberal, right, writing speeches for Walter Mondale, you know, writing for liberal publications, and then becoming really the voice of conservative thought in America, the articulate voice of conservative thought in modern America. And he's funny and he likes baseball. So so God bless him. Anyway, Jeremiah Workman, Gunner, coming up in 20 minutes and counting.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. What got you out of the Marine Corps? Were you medical?
Okay, this is part three. So these are experts. This is three different about somewhere between 11 and 15 minute segments of a 2-hour interview that I did. Remember, put it down, Workman. Listen to the whole interview. It's awesome.
They discharged. How did you get out of the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I was actually medically retired for PTSD and PBI.
So you're medically. How did you deal with the whole being medically retired thing?
Well, it had gotten to the point where I went from the museum to I was Sergeant Major Kent's driver for 2 years, and then back to Quantico to the Wounded Warrior Regiment, and it was made very clear to me that I was not going back to the infantry. So at that point, they said I could stay in the Marine Corps as long as I wanted to, but I was not going back to the infantry. And that was what I wanted to do. Right. So.
That was your professional hope, and I get through this stuff, I'll go back to the grunts, I'll be with my people, I'll be with my tribe, I'll be good to go.
Yep. No, when I went on the med board, I actually had come to terms with, you know, if I can't go back to the infantry, I think it's time for me to move on to the next chapter of my life.
So let me bring us up to date on the mental health stuff. So you're going to see mental health providers, and are you making progress or not making progress relative to your PTSD?
As far as
and your demons.
What time period?
We're talking when you're driving for the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps before your med board.
No, I was going to mental health quite a bit. I was making pretty good progress. Sergeant Major Kent was instrumental in getting me back on my feet, and like I said, he was like a father to me, and he just played a significant role in getting me out. Not just me, but my family. And, yeah, that really started to get me to where I need to be.
So then when they sat you down and counseled you and said, hey, look, you're just not going to get there, and you're not going to be able to be full up round, did you accept that at first when you heard that news, or how did that play in Peoria?
I was bummed out because after I reenlisted the first time, I knew I was going to do at least 20 years in the Marine Corps. That was my goal.
Right.
But I had to take a serious, honest look in the mirror, and I knew, like, would I really trust myself leading Marines in combat? I had to ask myself that question. And that was tough.
And what was the answer?
I don't think I would trust myself.
Why not?
Just, yeah. If I, if, God forbid, another bad experience like what happened in Fallujah. And,
You wouldn't be able to live with it.
Yeah, I'm not fully over it.
Right.
I don't know that if I could put into words what it is when you hear a leader in the Marine Corps saying, I don't know if I could trust myself. It's what we do. It's our contribution. You know, when you cross that line of putting on our blood stripe on your trousers as an enlisted Marine or becoming a leader, our blood stripe that we won at Chapultepec in Mexico, that blood stripe, yeah. You're a leader. It's what you do. When you have to come to the realization that I don't think I can do it anymore, I mean, that's devastating. So that which I've earned, that which I pride myself in, that which I love, I don't know that I could do that. As you listen to the anguish in his voice, that's why I respect him so much. He doesn't have to go there in this interview. He could say, hey, man, I'm out. This is a little bit much.
And people have told you, you're not gonna get over it, right?
Yeah.
You're not getting over that.
Yeah, it's a lot of people told me, you know, PTSD goes away when you die.
There you go. So you're getting med boarded and you have to accept that. And do you make peace with it, Jeremiah?
I do. Like I said, I knew I wasn't going back to the infantry, so I didn't have a choice. I made peace with it. And I started focusing on the next part of my life, the transition. I knew I had a family I had to take care of. And, I didn't really have time to sit around and pout about it. So.
That's some long, rough road. Are you still drinking as much at that point when you're getting out?
No, not nearly as much. No, I had really slowed down a lot. Thank God.
Would you still be alive if you weren't married, if your wife didn't hang in there with you?
You know, between her, Sergeant Major Kent, Sergeant Major Booth, some of these other folks that have been in my life, I don't think so. I don't know where I'd be.
Talk to me about the advice that you give to other veterans. You're working for the VA now, helping Marines, you know, get the things that they deserve. What advice when you talk about post-combat related mental health and you hear other guys hurting and they're struggling, what advice do you give them?
Well, the first thing I tell these guys and gals is you cannot be afraid to raise your hand and get help. There was a time in the Marine Corps where it was not okay to raise your hand and say you needed help. We're past that in the Marine Corps.
Are you sure? Are you convinced of that?
I'm convinced. I believe that if you need help, the Marine Corps will get you help. I believe that.
Do you believe that you'll suffer professionally because of that?
No. I know plenty of Marines that have PTSD diagnosis that have gotten promoted. They're staff NCOs. They're moving up the ranks. And it hasn't affected them one bit. So that's the number one thing I tell them is you've got to raise your hand. You've got to say something. If you don't say anything, you're going to live with this. Or try to live with it like I did, and that's not good. When the monkeys make a jailbreak, nothing good happens.
Wait a minute. Say that again?
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, he goes, PTSD, it's like having a cage, in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once the bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
that's keep the monkey in the damn cage.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's awesome. Do you consider it a duty of yours that you have a voice, people recognize you, and that you have, while you have that voice and while you have a platform, you can make a difference in their lives, and you feel kind of morally obligated as a leader to go do that? Do you feel that burden as well?
Yeah, I could never say no.
Right, right.
Especially when it was Marines asking.
Right.
Hey, can you come here and speak, or could you come to a warrior night or a mess night or whatever the occasion may be?
Right.
I never say no, because the fact that they're asking me, I mean, it's humbling. And it means the world to me that they even give it, you know.
Shit. Yeah, or rat's ass, either one.
But it is definitely time for me to slow down a little bit and spend a little more time with the family.
The first thing you said is don't be afraid to raise your hand. And then we got into this discussion about is there a stigma or not, and that led us to other places. What's the second thing you tell them?
Just, so you got to raise your hand. And then the second thing is whatever you, if it's medication, it's medication. If it's talk therapy, if it's group therapy, whatever it is that helps you, stick with it. Because a lot of people, they go to counseling two or three times and they feel better, and then they stop, and then they relapse, and it's just a dog chasing its tail. So you got to stick with it until you get to a place where you're in control of it and it's not in control of you. And that's really what I tell people, is until you can grab this thing by the horns, you need to stick with it. Because I've seen way too many people quit their meds. Oh, I feel great, man. I'm going to quit taking my meds. No, that's not a good idea. You know, they've gotten a lot better with the whole medication piece, too.
How so?
Back in the day. Well, like when I was first diagnosed, I mean, they shoved 13, 15 pills down my throat a day. Now I think I take 3. You know, just enough to, you know, for depression and a few things like that. I mean, I'm not a zombie. I'm alert. I'm in my right mind. It just keeps me even keeled. So I don't think they're over-medicating people like they used to, you know, 10 years ago.
Interesting. Because that's one of the major complaints you hear from Marines is that, you know, they're more than willing to give me medications, but nobody wants to talk to me, and I need to talk to somebody. I need to deal with this stuff I got in my head. Give some advice to Marines that feel that they're being over-medicated and they don't like it. Like you talked about being a zombie. I mean, I've heard that before, Jeremiah. You have so much experience in this field. What would you tell Marines to do that are feeling like that?
Yeah, if you feel like you're being over-medicated, only you know. You know when enough is enough. And if you got to switch doctors, you got to switch doctors. That's your right. You don't have to stay with the same guy or gal. I switched doctors several times until I found one that I actually liked. And we found a happy medium of medication and therapy. So if you feel like you're being over-medicated, you got to put your foot down and say, hey, doc, this isn't working. You know, I'm a zombie. It's affecting my family. It's affecting my job. And if they don't listen, you seek a new doctor. That's your right as a patient.
But don't quit. Don't quit going.
Don't quit. That's it. Don't quit. Yeah, it's awesome. You know, my son's dying. He's the starting quarterback on the football team now.
Yeah.
So I'm that guy on the sidelines hooping and hollering. I'm not the crazy dad.
You know, you're not that guy?
Yeah. I'm not that guy. But I definitely do a little bit of yelling. my daughter, she acts just like me. It's
Uh-oh.
Oh, it's almost scary a little bit. But you're right. Being a father is the greatest gift that you can be given. And I'm just glad that I was given really a second opportunity to be a dad, to be a husband, because I've screwed this thing up many a times. And the fact that they're still here, you know, it speaks a lot. It speaks volumes about my wife. And I wouldn't be where I'm at without her. And, you know, we're doing good. Things are good. Things are looking up.
Scott, first of all, I've taken up so much of your time, and I want you to know how much I appreciate your story. It's a powerful one, and with a good ending, which makes it a quintessentially Marine story. Because one of the things I hear all the time doing interviews is improvise, adapt, and overcome. You know, it's the motto of NCOs and leaders in the Marine Corps everywhere, and you have certainly gone down a tough road, and I just want to tell you how proud we are of you, and what a great example you are, because you're not a perfect guy, but you're a fighter, and you've hung in there, and you know your family's still intact, and you're the best days of your life are ahead of you. That's your son. Gets ready to go to Ohio State playing football. And, no, but it is, and it's a good ending, and God bless you. And, thank you so much for coming on and your honesty and your frankness. What an awesome Marine, in all the way around that you are. And thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. The, yeah, the whole interview you can find on the website. It's 2 hours and, it's on YouTube as well. The audio is, and, with some pictures of Staff Sergeant Workman is on YouTube as well. On the All Marine Radio channel on YouTube. That's right. Multimedia company, folks. Boom. Deal with it. Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, that's right. The prince himself, Michael Musselman, will join us. You got that to look forward to. So, sit back, relax. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.